Okay. It's not necessary for particle physicists and not even necessary for field theories, even though the title is Particles and Fields and Turbulence. To some extent, I want to show that we really grown up and we have particles, we have fields, we have almost everything which is any self-respectful physics is supposed to have. And of course, turbulence is a subject which is of great importance for different applications, but also the subject is interesting by itself. And I, in my talk, I'll kind of try to talk more about why turbulence per se is interesting, why indeed so many people, including so many great people, tried to solve it in some way and why they failed, and in what really is the state of the art we now, as far as not this application side of turbulence theory, but as far as understanding of fundamental problem. And of course this fundamental problem is part of a more wider subject, which is non-equilibrium physics. And in non-equilibrium physics, a dream would be to have something like equilibrium physics. And it's a moment reflection that's clear that it's impossible, because what we have in equilibrium physics, we have beautiful statistical physics and thermodynamics, and we know that if system is left alone somehow, then everything that we should know is a set of integrals of motion. Then we have Gibbs equipartition on the surface of those integrals of motion. Could be realized, if not that state of universality, but could we to some extent approach it. And it is immediately clear that as long as system is deviated from equilibrium, there are many ways to deviate it from equilibrium, and in this respect there could not be a single universal description. That's in a way how turbulence comes into focus, because turbulence more or less corresponds, at least what is usually called developed turbulence, to some particular way of deviating system from equilibrium, namely that usually we not force every degree of freedom away from equilibrium. We usually force some small parts of the degrees of freedom, usually the largest modes of the system, sometimes smallest scale of the system. We force them very far away from equilibrium, and then we allow system to arrange itself so that other degrees of freedom will be somehow arranged in a way that system itself, because it is a nonlinear system, it somehow redistributes this excitation. And very interesting how system would arrange itself to keep with this excitation that we apply to some end of the system. A related problem is the problem of decaying turbulence. When we, in some, in principle, general way, deviate system as far away as we can from equilibrium and then allow it to evolve. And we ask, as it evolves for a very long time, and it is still far away from equilibrium, is there any universal law that governs the statistics of this system? And the first idea naturally comes when we consider this way that we deviate only, say, one or few largest degrees of freedom. Then the natural idea how system would arrange itself in a way is a continuation of the idea of statistical physics, that what is important really is an integral of motion. So what is important is how much, let's say, energy as an integral of motion we input in the system per unit time. And this should somehow determine the state of the system. And of course there are many turbulences, and in principle any system could be deviated from equilibrium, but historically and also practically and also fundamentally, probably one of the most interesting is the fluid turbulence, which is described by well-known Navier-Stokes equation. U is a vector three-dimensional field, and we consider it incompressible and density will be unity, and we assume that we have some forcing applied to it, and this forcing as series-like would be a random function, but having only some large scales, and very interesting in the statistics of this vector field U at much smaller scales. So the first, probably that's what tomorrow will be called the zeroth law of turbulence, is actually generalization of experimental statement, that if we have some input into our system due to this force F, in a very long time, the system reach a steady state, whatever small this coefficient nu and this is coefficient of dissipation is. This is an experimental fact. A generalization of this experimental fact based on it is so-called Kolmogorov-Ofius law, which is basically the first step in trying to understand microstatistics of turbulence in terms of this integrals of motion. So what really Kolmogorov did at 41, he multiplied this equation by u at some other point. He assumed that there is a statistical steady state. It was an assumption, which is really based on experiments, and there are some arguments that maybe it's not exactly so. And then he considered the distance between two points to be somehow much less than the typical scale L, which is a correlation scale of this forcing, but on the other hand, to be much larger, some viscous scale, which is proportional to this viscosity, and this is goes to zero as this viscosity goes to zero. And in this interval, what he derived, he assumed isotropy, and because of isotropy, this term, its correlation of P and V disappeared. Then this term disappeared because we assume this basically that nu going to plus zero. This term disappears because we assume steady state, and we have some cubic term equal to the correlator of Fv, which is basically the power that our force or energy per unit time. And what Kolmogorov derived as a result, he derived this statement that the third moment, which comes from here, longitudinal, which means projected on this vector, is equal to minus 4/5 epsilon r 1 2, where epsilon in these terms, it is just Fv correlation function, which comes from large scale forcing. But on the other hand, because it is a steady state, so exactly this energy which is put into our system per unit time by the force should be dissipated by our viscosity, which means that here it stands like, well, I write it like this. Okay? And basically the statement is that when nu goes to zero, this correlation function stays constant, which is probably the first example of what is now called anomaly in different situation. On the other hand, this result is a part of what one would like to have as a universality. The sum correlation function, now third moment, it's called third structure function, is absolutely independent on the properties of our way of excitation. It only knows about energy flux. And this idea was applied to many other systems, and with basically the same result. And the natural next step would be to say, okay, that's how it works. At a very small scale, system forgets completely about the way we excite it. It only remembers about the flux of integral of motion. So what we had for temperature in equilibrium system, which would be an average energy, now is replaced by flux, which is averaged energy input per unit time, and that's okay, we have universality. That was too beautiful to be true. And really, in a little bit formal way to say that everything is determined by this epsilon is to say that if I'm interested in the probability distribution of having velocity difference of that order on the scale of r, well, let me first write it like this, delta v of r. This probability distribution depends on two variables. In principle, both of them vectors, but you may ask when this is length and this is longitudinal projector of this difference. So the Kolmogorov next natural assumption after deriving this was to say that, well, this should be self-similar in a way that it has to behave in the following way. This law certainly agrees with this particular statement. Immediate consequence of this would be that if you calculate any moment number n, then it would behave as n over 3. If we have a self-similar distribution, and of course, I guess many know that it's experimentally not really so, and many people, myself included, for many years, I refused to believe that it is indeed established,
can
but
I ask a trivial question?
Yeah,
you go on? This is totally trivial, but is there some really, really subtle difference between U and V that the non is supposed to know about?
No, same thing.
No, U and V is the same thing, sorry.
I mean, the non-experts are supposed to...
Yeah, sorry, that's just... No, there is no subtleties, and basically there will be no subtleties in the talk. I'll be talking about most robust disagreements and about things that we don't understand completely, not just some subtleties. Okay? So what really happens is, this is of course should be proportional to R in some power, but it happens that this power depends on n in a non-trivial way, and what Kolmogorov would love to have, that for n equal to 3, we know that it is unity, and this is true. For n equal to 0, of course, it is 0. And then Kolmogorov would predict something like this, and the experiment really shows something like this. Okay? And this difference, when it is measured, I mean, it is small. But it exists. We now have no doubt about it. In particular, I mean, this part is more or less good measured. Here, it's very difficult to measure the difference, but because we know that this function has to be convex, from the fact that it here deviates from this law and here it passes through unity, we know that for n equal to 2, it does not equal to 2/3. So we know for sure that the spectrum, which means second correlation function, in K representation is not 5 over 3. 5 over 3 probably most famous incorrect result, but now we know that it is incorrect. This difference is small. And
you said there were two arguments at Kolmogorov.
Yeah. First was exact result, mm-hmm. and this result is true and experimentally is supported. And second was an assumption, which he clearly formulated as an assumption of self-similarity of this.
It's a very strong assumption.
It's a very strong assumption. Of course, it's this realization of dream of universality, that only epsilon matters. And now we know that it is not true. Even more dramatic. If
experiments are ambiguous.
No. Experiments are... Okay. But
I know what experiments you're talking about, but...
Okay, but now I would like to put into the blackboard another subject for which there is absolutely sure that the scale invariance is broken, namely the problem of so-called passive scalar. Let's say that on this velocity field, or on any other velocity field that I control in some way, I impose a scalar field, which is much easier problem. And this scalar field is just advected by my field, and of course it diffuses according to its diffusion coefficient, and I have also some pumping, which is the same. I assume that I have large-scale pumping. Inhomogeneous advection by velocity field produces large gradients. Those gradients dissipate due to diffusion. And this is a kind of another cascade, which is a scalar cascade. In this case, again, without this term, I have arbitrary function of theta conserved, in particular theta squared conserved. And I may develop the same kind of arguments. And in this case, the flux, which is conserved, will be something like this. It will be triple correlation function, but from the viewpoint of theta, it will be second order correlation function. And one may develop this very type of argument that this what is phi theta I can call P, which will be flux of my scalar of theta squared. And again, I may assume that everything is determined by this flux. Yeah? At the point 2, again, it's u, sorry. So it's velocity taken at point 1, theta taken at point 1, and theta taken at 2. This two-point third-order correlation function.
But always at the same time.
But always at the same time, yeah.
And is the part of the theta squared itself conserved with capital equal to 0 and a null function?
Yes.
Yeah, it is conserved. I mean, arbitrary function of theta is conserved because u is incompressible, d of u equal to 0, and that's the only case that I today consider.
Analogous to the 4/5 law.
Oh yeah, sure. It's called Yaglom relation. Yeah. Well, but this is, this my students in the course do usually for 3 hours, and this one do for 15 minutes. But it's that straightforward.
This is another really stupid question. In many fields of physics, people always talk about it when it's like that Green's function, correlation function. It's always written at different time, and then when you differentiate with respect to time, you get some source form, right? And you extract somehow in this way more information, right?
Yeah.
Why is it that in this field you always look at equal time?
It's impossible to develop close description on the language of equal time correlator. So if you want to develop some kind of, it's impossible.
Impossible.
So as usual, when you want a complete field theory, you have to have different correlation functions. But in particular, when you have a conservation law, then you can derive some relation on a single time correlation function. And that's what has been really done here, all here. But of course, you do need different time correlation function for
example,
a total...
In here, if you do the different time correlation function, do you get more information?
Yeah, but again, because it's nonlinear system, I cannot close it, and I can write infinite systems, which is of not much help. Anyway, what is known about this system is even more dramatic, that if now I would write the structure function for my scalar field, they also behave in a power way, but this psi n is even more dramatically deviate like this. And in this sense, what we do know now from the experiment, that the scale invariance is broken, that probability distribution of this is not scale invariant, the probability distribution of this is also not, it's really like this, delta theta r. It's also not scale invariant. There is less universality that we would desire, in a sense that our small scale statistics knows much more about the way how we excite it at large scale than we would believe that it knows only by knowing about this conservation law. So the question is, what really our system still remembers? I mean, we excite it at a very large scale. Then we measure something at very small scales. And somehow, the very fact that this zeta n is not equal to n over 3, and dimensionally, of course, it should be like this. So if there is any deviation, that means that you have some what we usually call anomalous dimension, and that means that the scale of pumping, the large scale comes. So in a way, our statistics remembers how many steps in the cascade I passed, okay? And not in this problem so far, but in this problem, we really achieved some probably partial understanding of what really is the mechanism of this scale invariance broken, and what do our system remember about pumping. And of course, as any physicist would guess, if you break dimensional arguments, then there should be some hidden conservation laws or hidden symmetries that really exist in the system and which system should respect. So in this particular case, we have what could be called our Ising model. Namely, we have some very particular, very specific model, still physical in a sense that it could be realized in a physical experiment. But the system for which we can do a lot of things, we can calculate a lot of things, and we can understand. And I'm not going to tell about calculations, but I'll try to show you what really could be understood. And then, at the end, I'll try to discuss what are the questions left and what we learn from it. So this model is called Kreitman model. It's really very old. It has been formulated 68, and then... but probably even before. And it is a model for which U is considered to be Gaussian and delta correlated in time. So we are saying that U at some TR, U0, 0, this correlation function, is everything that we should know about velocity field, because it is Gaussian. Then it is delta function of time. And as far as function of space, it will be, of course, some constant. Let's call it.
What is this called? Is this an assumption or?
This is an assumption. Oh, in principle, I can create whatever velocity field I want, because I shouldn't necessarily excite it at large scale. I may just apply my force, you know, minutely to every scale and impose on my velocity field whatever statistic I want. But it's unpractical. It's stupid, but I can do it.
But then this may or may not correspond to a simple stirring force.
Oh no, it does not. It does not. Sure. It does not. So I'm assuming now velocity which has nothing to do with this problem of steering at large scale.
By the way, just curious, experimentally those inequalities are very well satisfied by several orders of magnitude.
Oh yeah. Yeah, especially in astrophysics there are a lot of scales. Sorry for mentioning in vain. Okay, so this correlation function is supposed to have the following form, and here is, because it's a vector, so it's some tensor. And this tensor depends on R, and we assume that it is scale invariant, and we say that it behaves like 2 minus gamma, and gamma will be our parameter, which is nice, because when it's like this, it means that velocity field is specially smooth too, that it just expanded in the even orders of R. But we want to have it with some non-trivial scaling. In particular, we may try to model the scaling of this field. But what is important is this delta function of time, because as long as here is delta function of time, then for such velocity for Gaussian, now from this equation, I'm just multiplying it by theta at different points at the same time and averaging over velocity statistics, I can get closed equation for any correlation function of theta field. And if I called Fn the correlation function theta 1, theta n, and they are all special points, but time is the same. And I assume, again, that the distances between any of these two points from the one hand much smaller than the correlation scale of this forcing. On the other hand, much larger than the scale determined by this diffusivity, which again will be assuming to be small, then I can get equation which looks very simple. And it actually was derived by different people. It was probably published first by Scheimann and Sidger, but derived by Kreitman before, derived by Misha Chertkov also independently. And what we really see, we see that here when we average over u, we will have pair correlation function of u with two differentiation operator. And really what will be here will be sum over all pairs of points, ka of rij, sum over ij, grad I, grad j. Okay? And it also acts on fn. And I neglect what comes from here because I assume that all points are very far. And here will be some correlation function. And if I assume that this phi is also Gaussian with its correlation function chi, so here it will be something like chi f n minus 2 order. So in this sense, if I can do it for second order correlation function, here will be just chi, what is known for me. I solve it. Then I do it for fourth order correlation function with known right-hand side, etc. And of course, from here one may immediately see that because this is scale invariant operator, okay, then for n equal to 2, what I have on the right hand side, I have chi, and this chi is constant because I'm assuming scales which are much less than the typical scale of my pumping. And so f2 should be just constant multiplied by the r in this power. And this is scale invariant operator which has a scaling r minus gamma. This is, has 2 minus gamma, and this is minus 2. Okay? So, yeah?
Huh? I could erase the bracket where something subtle is going.
Which bracket?
There's no
I promised not to speak about any subtleties. So this is second order correlation function, which comes immediately, and one may check that because for second order correlation functions, the only variable is the distance between points, then it's ordinary differential equation, you solve it, you get it. Then you go for a fourth order correlation function, and you have this k grad grad fourth correlation function equal to second order correlation function. This you know that it is r to the power gamma. This operator is r to the minus gamma, so what can prevent you of having f4 not to gamma scaling? And of course, when it is already written like this, one immediate, and of course I'm considering steady state, which means that I don't have time derivative. Okay? And at that moment, it is clear what really can prevent me from having f4 scaling to gamma. It's if this operator has some zero modes, which means that there are some functions. Let's call this operator L. There are some functions that satisfy this relation. Okay? And so far, it's very formal. Now, I want to abandon for a while this way of description. I'm not going to tell you how we calculated those zero modes, how we discovered that they have anomalous scaling, etc. I'll try to give you an understanding of what is the physics behind this notion of zero modes. They dominate if their scaling is less, because when I go to small scales. And then it's a very, probably very interesting mathematical problem, which we still don't, did not analyze. How many modes at a given end, the whole algebra behind them, etc. But we do know that they appear with scalings both lower and higher than normal scaling, and they're always modes with a scaling lower, so they always dominate. So what is their physical meaning? How one may kind of understand them? And really, in a way, if you recall that here is dt, and you see that there is something which turns this operator into zero, one sees that this is in a way integral of motion of my system. So what is this integral of motion? What is the physics behind it? Okay, let's say that I consider particles. And here I want to come from fields to particles, because particle language is something which is very appropriate, well, not really to derive here, but to explain the physical meaning. So if I would have not this equation, but instead of this, just I would have usual diffusion, and the operator would be kappa plus F. I know what the physics behind diffusion is. It's a Brownian motion of my particles. Okay? So if I want to calculate two-point correlation function, I just have to take two particles and follow them how they go, and then integrate along those trajectories. Okay? Now, I don't know how two particles go when there is diffusion. Then R squared, let's call it R capital. This will be the distance between two particles. And I know that it goes like this. Okay? Now I may ask, is there is something which is conserved when I consider Brownian motion of two particles? Well, in a way, I may consider like four particles and take something like this. And this is an integral of motion, because the average of it is conserved, because kappa t terms, they cancel. Okay? Now, it's not interesting, because what I would like to have, as long as I consider, say, four particles, I would like to have some combination which is non-zero after all cyclic permutations, because when I measure correlation function, I don't distinguish between different particles. So I would like to have something which is non-zero after it. So the question, may I have something which depends on R12, R34, and which is non-zero? Well, sure, I can. It's very easy. You just make it like this, and you subtract D space dimensionality, and here is, then one may check that if you take an average of this with respect to the statistics of Brownian motion, or simply just act by Laplacian on it, because that's what is the respective Green function of this Brownian motion, that in this combination, all kappa t terms disappears, or in other terms, Laplacian, by acting on this mode, gives you zero. And this is an integral of motion, of our stochastic Brownian motion. And it is, in a way, well known, just I guess people never, especially in particular, paid any attention to it, because if I would be solving my diffusion problem with this operator instead of this, I would have my pair correlation function R squared, my fourth order correlation function R4, and this is R42. So it does not give me new scaling. So what's the difference when I pass from molecular diffusion to a turbulent diffusion? Is that now I change the law. So now there are some modes, some functions of distances, which also conserve. And you can do it just perturbatively, saying that my gamma is very close to 2, and in this case it would be very close to diffusion operator, and then one can do it perturbatively, like Dovetsky and Kupianian did it. Or one may do perturbation theory another way. But without calculation, it's clear that what exists in this simple limit also exists for basically absolutely arbitrary operator here. And of course, this is a trivial case, because I assume my velocity to be delta correlated in time. And if it is not delta correlated in time, then I don't have simple differential equation here. I have something, operator of turbulent diffusion, which depends on all prehistory. But the basic fact that if I take four points and I ask, if there is some combination of these distances which is constant, even though any distance grows this time, like here it grows linearly, then sure it is. It's a very general notion. And in this sense, then one may realize that what really happened, that those zero modes, this precisely correspond to every number of particles, they correspond to a given integral of motion. So in this sense, in this system, we identify these hidden statistical integrals of motion, this set. Okay?
And the motion can be written for a quantum system too, for a quantum system of particles?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. As long as you have non-stationary statistics, you have something growing, then in general you can always define something which is constant in time. And those are some combinations. What is different from a trivial case of diffusion? That for this operator, zero modes, they have non-trivial scaling exponents. And when one calculates them and puts them here, you'll see that those exactly for n equal to 4, 6, etc., they are exactly the exponents which determine the correlation function. So in this sense, one may say, what really our system remembers? Because when I try to measure correlation function at small scales, then really, to calculate it as a theoretician, I have to track them back to the pumping scale where they come from. And on this way, they remember not only flux of energy, which is determined in this case per correlation function. They determine in a way their shape. And that's in a way the first lesson that we learned, that there are statistical integrals of motion, that zero modes which really determine all the correlation function at small scales, they are nothing but scaling structure preserved in average by the flow. It's not a dynamical integral of motion. It is a statistical integral of motion. When I average over dynamics of n, 4, 6, 8 particles, I get this integral of motion. So this was the first lesson, and as such, it is basically about particles, or what is trivially related to the particles, to this scalar field. Then one may ask, okay, so this curve, psi n, to what extent it is universal? Because, I mean, let me remind, what we are looking for, we are looking for universality. We are trying to understand what is really universal in turbulence. It's already clear that we may have different ways of pumping. But this zero modes of this operator, they knew nothing about pumping, how we pump our scalar. Are they universal to the extent how they dependent or independent on this field U? And they are dependent. This is the first message. The second message, okay, it's a complicated curve now. So we understand qualitatively that it should not be a straight line because every n given by its own integral of motion. Is there still a way somehow to understand it simply, not to calculate it, but to understand it in more simple terms? And actually this way come when people calculated the asymptotics here at n going to infinity. Okay? When n going to infinity, that physically means that you measure very high moments. Or in other terms, you are interested in this probability distribution function for very large delta theta. Or you are interested in the tails of probability distribution. That would correspond to this moments of very large n. And what has been shown by different people, there were hypotheses by Yehot and then Chertkov and Lebedev and Balkovsky, shown that this goes to a constant. So we now know for sure, we don't know it for velocity, even though I believe that for velocity it also goes to a constant, we know that this curve has a constant asymptotics. Which suggests that the physics is very simple. It suggests that as you go to a very, very high moments, you stop changing, really, if you consider arbitrary systems, that this transition happens at n much larger than d, where d is space dimensionality. This probably also interesting. This result was found by some kind of what we call instanton formalism, which is a very simple idea that if you are looking for a very high fluctuation, then you are looking for very rare events. And they are determined by saddle points or by some local extremum of probability. And then you look for this optimal fluctuation, which could be
so
called instant.
Kind of idea that goes into sort of Lipschitz scale
exactly. It's exactly exactly. This is the idea of optional fluctuation. That the very high moments or very distant scales of PDF determined by some rare fluctuation, by some special fluctuation, which you can find by settle point and pass integral.
Right, which field theory is called instanton.
Which field theory is called instanton, and because it's short as an optional fluctuation, we call it instanton too. And in this case, one can understand completely that the physics, which determines high moments, it is something which is very simple. It's a local realization of your field theta, which just has some jump. It's a shock wave.
So something else I did not understand. What does this have to do with whether there's a zero mode or no zero mode? Is that important? The zero mode is that a separate issue?
In a way, I am speaking about the same subject. I am speaking about this field. I am speaking about its exponents. I can get them by zero modes. I mean this tell. I know that for any n, it is a zero mode which is determined the correlation function. But now I would like to look at it from a different perspective, which in a sense complementary, in a way it's also complementary approach to calculate, but it's also a very nice physical approach, which is much older, of course, than the idea of zero modes. What are the physical structures that are behind this? And as long as you see this saturation, you may say that there are some physical structure which determine not this moment, but the whole tail, all the moments with very large n, they are determined by a single structure. And this structure could be identified as some shock here, which is very simple. Why it is the shock? It's really like this. You ask, what is the very high moment, theta 1 minus theta 2 in the power n? Okay? And if you say that all the moments at very large n are determined by such shock, then what should be here, it is just some delta theta RMS in the power n multiplied by the probability of having shock in this interval. But this probability, because shock is much more narrow than your distance between points r and 2, is already independent on r1, 2. So it's only this that would depend on R12, and that's the mechanism of saturation. In particular, you have this for Burgers. For Burgers' equation, if you ask what is V1 minus V2 in the power n, and say that it is R12 in the power zeta n, then this zeta behaves like this as a function of n. Because Burgers is about shocks. And here, eventually, it's not that simple, because for Burgers, when you pass one, you just switch into it. Here you have a smooth curve, because when you increase number of points, increase n, you mean you increase number of points. You still exploit geometry of your space. But when your number of points is much larger than the geometry of space, you have nothing to exploit, and they are the same zero modes, which basically determine you the exponents. Okay. And I can find this large value of moments as using this n as a settle point parameter in the path integral. This was basically the idea of formalism. Yeah.
You don't mean a dynamic shock, just a jump, right?
No, like picture. I mean, like you look at the field of the realization, and at a given instant of time, you see there are jumps, and those jumps determine high moments, and you can.
But there's no dynamics.
Well, dynamics is something which creates them, in a way, because initially you start, your pumping produces very smooth field theta, then velocity brings, okay? So eventually it's all very simple. On the one hand, we succeeded in putting all this anomalous scaling stuff into more or less general context of physics, so we have now understanding that Weyl-Skilling invariance is broken because of hidden integrals. We know how to describe respective structure as respective optimal fluctuation, which comes over there. Now, what here, I mean, before returning to turbulence, what here is not understood yet? So in a way, we now know that those scaling exponents, they really tell us something about dynamics of the system. They know how particles separate and what are the integrals of motion which they still preserve when they separate. We know that the system is not universal in a sense that if we would like to ask about single point statistics of this field theta, it is dependent on the pumping. A very difficult question is the following, that can we have here something like operator product expansion? And I'm not going to write it, I just say a few words. Operator product expansion, at least a simple understanding of fluid mechanics, is a statement that if you consider correlation function with endpoints, and here you will consider some two points which approach each other, then you may express this correlation function in terms of lower order correlation function. In a way, it's a very powerful idea, and it actually tells you that here what you would like to know, it's only the probability distribution function of theta at a point, which means that theta squared, any moment of theta, it is non-universal, it's given by pumping, it's non-interesting for a physicist, assume you know it. Now you would like to know R dependencies. And those R dependencies, they are given by those exponents. Okay? But I would like to have only basic set and express any correlation function in terms of this basic set of exponents. So in this sense, if we would succeed in doing that, we would put at least this simple example of turbulence of Kreitman model in our Ising model into more or less general context of physics. And we don't know yet. So this is an unsolved problem, which I consider very important. And the second related problem is what I mentioned at the beginning, that one may say that I may look for universality, not considering necessarily some forcing. I might just say, okay, I created initially very non-equilibrium state, very far from equilibrium, and then I let it evolve. And if this evolution is sufficiently long, then system somehow should organize itself into something which is determined by only the properties of the system, and not by the way by which I initially deviated very strongly. And in our jargon, this is called the problem of turbulence decay. And in this sense, again, one may ask, in this case, I have probability distribution of any quantity and also time. It is non-steady probability distribution. What is it? Is it related in some way to those anomalous scaling? To what extent those anomalous scaling determine the way how nth moments decay? This is also an unsolved problem. In a way, it is very important because, as I said, it's another attempt to find any universality. Now,
can I ask a question about the zero moment?
Yeah.
This L operator that you wrote down, for which you look for zero moment, this K,
this is
red graph, right? So I can see a trivial zero moment because it's constant zero moment.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Is there some more subtle zero moments, more complicated zero moments that I can see?
A
short example?
Assume that you have Laplacian. You do have constant.
Right.
But you also have some zero mode which is R squared, some zero mode which is R to the 4, etc.
Oh, you assume it's Laplacian.
No. Let's say that there is a Laplacian here. It's not surprising that you have zero modes which aren't only constant. Now you consider Laplacian with a non-trivial, somehow it's Laplacian in a curved space. And there exist non-trivial zero modes. And they somehow, in a very strange way, depends on the order. So one may show that when you increase n, the number of modes goes like 2, 5, 6, 15, 26. And I would love to see some algebra which gives this number. But
does the curved space correspond to something interesting, some interesting manifolds?
That's well beyond my mathematical abilities. My feeling is that there is some very beautiful mathematics behind it. But what I'm saying is we just counted with Misha Chertkov this number of modes until number. And that certainly they come from some, I don't know, most probably some braid groups, they come from it. Yeah, but I cannot get it. So, because in a way, what you really exploit when you create your zero modes, you exploit cyclic permutation between points. Okay? Like I did it for Laplacian. You really create something which, after cyclic permutation, change sign. And the number of zero modes is basically the number of ways you may create different permutations. Because you may do it with subset of points, or you may with larger subset, and then with all the points. That's how different zero modes come into play.
You know how to construct zero modes for any end and count them?
That's how we count them.
There's a formula for any end?
No.
So you only know it for a few.
Oh yeah, Misha, where we finished? We finished at n equal to 10, I guess.
But your L that you wrote down is, at least on the blackboard, is independent of n, right?
Oh, it depends, because here is sum over all pairs. It's always second order operator.
Oh, I see.
But when you increase n, you increase the number of variables.
Oh.
So for four points, it's six-dimensional space. You have six distances between four points.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go higher, there are more and more variables. But it's still second-order differential operator. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Now, that's the lesson that we learned here. That is still very far from understanding really what is the degree of universality. But to some extent, we succeeded at least in identifying one element of this breakdown of scale invariance. One may ask what we can tell now about velocity field and the initial problem for which we have vector field with this Navier-Stokes equation. Yeah.
There's been a lot of work on this operator product expansion by the St. Petersburg group. I mean, what do you think of that? Because you mentioned it's just sort of an open problem, but they seem to have a
all the work on operator product expansion that I saw, they really counted exponents. And as far as counting exponents, it's okay. All the fusion rules work in the sense that when in that operator you fuse some points and you count exponents, scalings, left and right, they are the same. Which is absolutely trivial. I don't find anything in particular. It's in a way, I mean, Cracknell already knew it. But operator product expansion is much more than the statement about exponent. It's a statement about coefficients. And that's the most important point.
But they are getting out scaling exponents.
Oh, scaling exponents are okay. But when you say that there is operator product expansion, you're telling that you take any correlation function. It's a very powerful idea. And I myself...
Scaling exponents isn't totally obvious because those are coming from very, you know, zero modes, according to you.
Yeah. But, well, in a way it's straightforward to see that when you fuse, there is always this number of points n which determines everything, and then when you try to make any fusion rules, it doesn't matter, the n stays the same, how many fields you have. But what is most subtle is when you start to expand with respect to this difference, and you ask what is the analytical structure with respect to this expansion, and what are the coefficients. So as we have in, say, conformal field theory, I mean, in any field theory, really. And here, unfortunately, that's what basically Zamolochikov is trying now to do. And because in a way, it's a simple system. We have equation. We have equation for any correlation function. But still a lot of, because it's...
Can you translate the statement about the critical exponent, I mean, the whatever the dynamics dimension going to constant as n goes to infinity, the curvature over there?
Mm-hmm.
Can that be translated in terms of exactly how the number of zero modes must grow with n?
No. It has nothing to do with the number of zero modes. It is a scaling exponent of the largest... is the largest current exponent of the zero mode. Because this exponent is what corresponds to, and we always can identify the zero mode which corresponds to the largest exponent. It is, I don't know how we call it, irreducible. It's a zero mode which involves all n points. Because when I have n points, I can also exploit some subset of it. And it always gives me scaling which is over there. And I need the lowest scaling, because I go to small r, so I need the lowest exponent.
That's
it's given.
Well,
you know, it's when I fuse, what I produce my viscous scale also in some power. And the power in which it is always determined by the anomalous exponent of number n, which was in the initial correlation function. So in this sense, it's, again, the scalings are to some extent trivial. What is non-trivial is it really exists, this operator product expansion? Because, I mean, you can talk a lot, but when you try to calculate it, which we really tried a few months ago, I mean, it's very technical, which I believe is still solvable, as well as this problem about...
You're saying that the Wilson coefficient, you're interested in the Wilson coefficients, not just when you have power...
Exactly. I'm not interested in coefficient per se. I'm interested to know if such a kind of expansion exists, because nobody guaranteed it for me, just nobody. Okay, I mean, it's turbulence. It's something for which we don't have anything from the very beginning. We don't have Gibbs distribution. We don't have any variational principle. We have nothing. We can just solve problem by problem, one by one, and trying to get some feeling of what it's all about. Okay, so I probably stop at this point. Maybe there are more questions. So now I'm not sure if it's necessary to reiterate, but just a very short conclusion. So from my viewpoint, the fundamental part of turbulence problem is a problem of universality. Now, absolutely clear that there is no universality in any wider sense that we thought before. In a way, any step that we do, at least in my history of doing this subject, on every step I kind of forced to abandon some more general notion of universality in favor of some more. But it seems that still there is some horse survives and probably will survive further. Okay, so as we like to quote Tolstoy, that all happy families I like, and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So in this sense, one may say that, okay, as long as we are in non-equilibrium, there is every unhappy family and it's its own mess. But it doesn't seem so, because what I try to show by this history of zero modes, the way to get this anomalous scaling is different in different systems, but the basic notion that there are hidden integrals of motion, they are statistical, they conserved in statistics, they depend on geometry, I guess it survives in any situation. Thank you very much.
After discovering them, you say, well, sort of, you generalize and say that the Bayesian hidden integrals of motion. That sort of.
It's non-trivial. I mean, look, it took few years for Virgasola to make numerics with not delta correlated velocity field, but with the real velocity field, and see that there are other scaling structures preserved exactly in the same way. On the other hand, I never had any doubt about it, because, I mean, it doesn't matter in which way your particle goes. So they go this way or in that way. You always can create some combination which stays. But this is hand waving. I mean, I understand it. Can I prove as a theorem that whatever the way of particle separation, then there are always some geometrical combination of it which is conserved? It's an interesting idea. I mean, maybe it's even possible under some assumptions. I'm looking at it because it's already mathematics.
This is a contractual statement, for example, endorsed limit we have, which is just explicit.
Which
large D limit dimensionality or.
Yeah.
But
we can do analytics. We just build them and we see how they. For Gavetsky limit, we can do it just from. Gavetsky limit is when this is almost Laplacian, which means that this is almost constant, and then you expand when it is a little bit, and you see how they appear from a trivial modes of Laplacian. So.
Richard,
yeah.
Where does Richardson?
Very good question. I don't know. Let me formulate the question. For actually, there is a statement that for a true velocity field in a real turbulence, when you ask what is the distance between points, which you remember grew linearly for diffusion, here it would go like cube of time because it's super diffusion. The more distance than you go, the more vortices that can bring them far apart, and that's. And again, it's a dimensional statement. One cannot derive it in a way, because when you say, okay, I have two particles and they separate, and let me integrate over all the small-scale motions, then you immediately discover that the last half of your evolution, the largest vortex of this very size, determines you the main contribution, and you cannot say that it is short-correlated and integrate against this central limit theorem-like statement. So, if this is true or not, I don't know. I personally believe that it doesn't true.
It's about
that there is something here.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's.
It's a bound. There's not an equality.
Huh?
It's a bound. It's a bound. Peter can prove it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But it could not be faster, you mean?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But could it be slower?
It could be slower.
It could be slower. That's my statement. Yeah. Actually, I mean, my guess that here is something with space dimensionality in the denominator, and I tried for a while to calculate it in 1 over d expansion, but... Minus. But I don't know how to calculate it in 1 over d, even though I think that it is 1 over d.
For
real turbulence. Oh yeah, it is related, of course. It's, of course, it's the same about Hall particles. But it might be that because this guy is only two particle object, then there is nothing anomalous, etc. But on the other hand, we do know that this assumes the scaling of velocity 2/3. And it is not 2/3 that we know. It's a little bit not, but it is. Okay? So that's why I believe that it is not 3 here.
Do you think real turbulence will also work out? Navier-Stokes,
but we now know that for a scalar field in a real Navier-Stokes, we have zero modes, we have anomalous exponent exactly because of this mechanism.
But
velocity is a vector field, and its zero modes or hidden statistical invariants are much more complicated. And in a way, velocity is an active field, not a passive, and it's always intermittency for passive field. I mean, this anomalous scaling, it's always larger for passive field, and it's much smaller for velocity itself. So I believe that idea in general, that there are hidden statistical integrals of motion, that what system remembers about pumping or large scale, it is this geometry of its motion. But what is it for velocity, for vector field, I have no idea. It's in a way tautology, because the moment I say that there is the my scale invariance is broken, the dimensional reasoning does not work, that there should be something else which my system remembers. That if it remembers something, then it's conservation law.
Well,
so it's, I did not tell you anything non-trivial. I just illustrated this with a lot of hand waving.
But that means also you could set up initial stirring conditions that are orthogonal to some of these zero modes and get very different behavior.
In a way, yes, yeah. We kind of never thought about it in a constructive way, how one can, let's say, first, but in principle, it's, of course, because you can calculate projection of any pumping on your zero modes. Yeah.
But all of these are sort of half, if you make a rotate, they're all rotationally
non-zero. Oh, they're all rotationally invariant, of course. Yeah. Yeah, of course. They depend only on the distances between points.
Right, but there must be non-invariant if you rotate all the particles.
Right? Oh, no. You can express any zero modes just in terms of the scalar variables, which are distances between points. Yeah.
Some different growth.
Well, for dynamos, you might be interested in something like how a line lengthens. So have the analysis calculations been done for?
Yeah, next Tuesday. We already settled the date. Yeah.
What about these jumps, like from the asymptotic scaling? There must be a distribution of them in strength and number. Can anything be said about that?
Actually, the statement that if it goes to constant is the statement that you always have jump of the order of root mean square value. And for very large n, it is them who determine the structure function. But of course, you have the whole hierarchy and all this curve. But the constant at large n is determined by the jumps of root mean square value. And they exist. This is basically the statement that they exist.
Plus a statement that average distance is much greater than your...
Oh, yeah, but that's a statement that jump is jump and not something which exists on the...
So if you have lots of jumps near each other, then...
There is no accumulation. Yeah, that's... In a way, it's also the statement that the jumps don't accumulate at some points. Yeah. But it's an interpretation. I mean, the result is obtained without invoking any assumption about jumps. You just go do saddle point and you get this scaling. And then you interpret it in a way that it is a jump who determines it. You see, this is what's called cliff and ramp. I mean, Srini can probably tell the story. I mean, it is very well documented, yeah. So in a way, here is everything. As far as all this stuff is concerned, I guess that we're almost over. What really bothers me about this passive scalar is whether the operator product exists and how decaying turbulence behaves. That's two questions that I think left here.
Another question?
Yeah.
Since diffusion is going to kill atomics, can you leave diffusion out of this? Is this in Reynolds number?
It's what's called Piclea. It's a very large Piclea number, but I mean this jump has a scale of diffusion. But I am considering distances which are much larger, and then I can show that it is independent. Diffusion can be counted in a perturbative way. I mean, there is no problem with accounting for diffusion here. Just absolutely regular procedure. I mean, all this story is how you go from large scale to small scales and what you remember on the way. How diffusion smooths at small scales, it's absolutely, I mean, everything is clear about it. There's no problem. I mean, Greg did a lot of work. And I mean, there is a real mathematics that proves that everything okay with this diffusion. Because it's now not a singular operator. I have my operator already of the second order. So when I add here Laplace, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, it could be treated regularly.
Okay, thank you.